Welcome, everyone, to Renegade Radio. I am your host, Andy Lowe, and we're here and ready for another exciting episode of how companies are breaking the rules of conventional thinking to create amazing results inside of their organizations. And today's going to be no exception to that show. As always, we're brought to you by Renegade Concepts and the good folks here at Business Radio X. My guests in the studio today are Jennifer Bull, she's from Spark Ideas, and Glenn Bachman from Bachman International. Guys, welcome to the show today.
Thanks, Andy.
It's great to be here.
Good. Well, Jennifer, let me start with you. So Spark Ideas, you're the CEO over there, and you guys are transforming organizations through the employees, as I understand. But before I tell people what you do, why don't, in your own words, you tell us a little bit about how you guys work with organizations and what do you help them do?
We work and benchmark with national and global organizations. Our largest client right now is Medtronic. They're based in Minneapolis, but they're located out in California, the group we work with. And a lot of people come to us and they're finding that they're losing their top talent. They're not sure how to motivate their leaders of the future. They're sensing that there is a frustration from the people who work for them, and they're not quite sure what the issues are and how to address them. So we go in and work with them and try and figure out what the issues are, and then we come up with solutions to fix it, and then we communicate those and follow up and make sure that everything we do has a sustaining component to it. It's a great job to feel like you are connected to something that makes people feel happier, makes companies run better, and just helps, you know, customers and people in general be better and, you know, buy more stuff and get great customer service and puts them in better moods.
Well, let me ask a question. I mean, when we think about the current job market, and I get a few years ago, job market's, you know, not very laden with talent. Everybody's employed, companies are busy, they're trying to steal talent from one company to another. Now the job pool is full. There's a lot of talented people sitting on the sidelines. Why do I care if people walk out? What do I care if my people are motivated? There's somebody else sitting out there ready to take their job at half the price.
Right. Well, that's true in some cases, but I think that companies that are looking forward and companies that are actually successful right now, they're experiencing a talent mismatch. So they actually have open jobs. They have a lot of open jobs in technology, the medical industry, research and development, and they can't find the right people for them. And some jobs go open, you know, a year or so. They have not the right talent. And meanwhile, they're losing ground because they have positions that are not filled. And, you know, they can't really go out and find somebody for half the price to do that particular thing. And a lot of companies are already coming to us saying, not only can they not find people for the positions that they need to fill, but they're losing their talent to other people. They feel like they don't know what to do to keep them.
Now, is this a talent problem or a culture problem? I've heard a lot of people come through our show in the recent past saying that talent's not really the issue. They can find people with the skill. They're having trouble finding people to fit their culture. Are you seeing that same phenomenon?
Yes, I'm seeing that. A lot of people are coming. So some of the managers who I've been talking to at large companies are coming and saying, you know, we're no longer going to even hire on technical skills. That's only going to be 25% of what we look to see. What we're going to hire on is what we call, you know, business skills. If people have a leadership quality, if people are engaged, if they're good at managing other people, if they can answer our questions in an energized way. They're looking, so a hotel, for instance, they might be looking for people to come in and work the front desk who have certain qualities. They might not care as much anymore if people know the booking system or if they've worked for Marriott before or something like that. What they want is people who can look people, customers in the eye when they come in and be able to ascertain if they are in a good mood or in a bad mood and get them the right thing. And that skill is something that is highly valued and not always. You have to be very particular when you're hiring people to get at whether or not they have those skills.
So how do you establish that culture initially inside an organization? Or do you do that? Do you go in and assess where the culture currently is and then try to add to that? Or do you go in and say, hey, you guys really have no defined culture. Let's define your values. Let's define your culture so you do know who you're trying to hire and how to retain the people you have.
Sometimes we go in and people Well, everybody has a culture, whether or not a lot of people come to us and say we have no culture, and we need to.
I have no culture.
We need to you know, create one. And here's what we want to be. We want to have people who are selfless, who'll go the extra mile. We want people who, you know, are innovative. We want people, and they try and put out there what they want, and that's good. Leadership needs to do that to a certain extent, but also. They have something that they've inherited, so they need to figure out where they are right now, and then they need to understand where their aspirations are, and then they need to work to close the gap. And so in some cases, we're helping them figure out who they are and where they want to go. It's a mixture of both.
Do you find incongruencies in what companies tell you they want their culture to be and what leadership is the culture it's actually creating?
Yes.
And what do you do when that happens?
We work with them to show them in more black and white terms that things are not as leadership wants them to be. One of the things that happens is leadership talks to leadership a lot. So leadership is repeating back to each other what they're telling each other. So they're thinking everything's great. I talked to, you know, my partner down the hall the other day, and he, you know, said the exact same things that I think. So everything's working. But then if you go a level down or two levels down, people down there just don't get it. And one of the best things people can do to motivate their employees and get them to do all the things that they want them to do, like provide good customer service, win new customers, things like that, is help them understand exactly what they do every day, how that impacts the big picture in a business, from a business standpoint. And if people are coming to work and they don't understand how what they do impacts the customer every day, then companies are not going to get that engagement that they want from people, and their people are not going to be able to deliver what the company says they were going to deliver for the customer. And there's a huge mismatch there.
Well, that's very true. I think Daniel Pink he's got a little YouTube thing out there that I've seen before that really highlights that issue about motivation of people. And for basic rudimentary tasks, you know, money can be a motivator, but that's really not ultimately what drives an organization. So what would you say to leadership as far as what they should be paying attention to in order to motivate their employees, especially in this market?
Well, one of the things that we've, in our research and benchmarking, just even especially over the past month, people have been saying that they are really stretched thin and burnt out and very tired. And leadership, I think, feels the same way, because they are working the same or more that everybody else in the company is working for. And they see things that people who are at lower levels maybe don't see. But people are tired. And, you know, I think they're willing to work hard. As a matter of fact, our surveys and studies say that people would list one of the three things about them as being hardworking. And they feel like they're willing and are making sacrifices for the company. But I don't know that they feel recognized for it. And leadership is, you know, I think people, sometimes leadership might feel like, well, I'm working hard too. They just need to deal with it. But when you have an industry where it's going to be hard to keep your top talent in the next few years, people are going to be snatching them away. People are leaving because they're burnt out. And you have to find particular skill sets with people who have a little bit of everything beyond the technical skills. I think you need to address the fact that people are tired and people are stretched thin, and the resources and support that they had in the past might not come back for a really long time.
So what do you do to recognize those employees? I mean, we've seen a lot of different incentives and things like that inside of organizations. Which ones work and which ones don't?
Well, one of the things that this is a little bit, I think, maybe different to what you're asking, but one of the things that really motivates people, the most meaningful event to people at work, the thing that can make the most difference in their job, is seeing that they're making progress in meaningful work. And leadership can see that things are moving along. They know what's ahead of them a mile, 2 miles, 5 years down the road. But, you know, if you're a project manager at a large company and you're tasked with an awful lot of things and you have less resources to do it, you are not seeing the progress that you're making. And when you can't see the progress, you often lose the vision that you have. Like, you no longer understand how you're impacting the customer, if you're making a difference. Then you start really chipping away at the culture, even great cultures. And, you know, people have said this forever. They say, you know, you build trust over decades and years, you lose it in a second. And that's true. People, you know, maybe it's not in a second, but people stay that one extra night. They're not recognized in the team meeting. Maybe their leadership is recognized. You know, how recognition is handled is another big issue. And people are, you know, employees are ready, I think, to, well, what they're telling us from the studies is that they're ready to go the extra mile, but they're feeling like they need help. And I think the help, the managers, what managers can really do and what leadership can really do, people managers are so important, is to help them understand the progress they're making and always keep in sight for them how they are impacting the customer. Those front desk people, people who make beds in hotels, who clean the rooms, they might not see the customer ever, but they need to understand how what they do provides just the superior customer service, hopefully, and feel good about that.
So who is an ideal target for the type of services that, that you provide at Spark Ideas?
An ideal target is a national, well, a regional, national, global company, but the work we do has mostly been with national and global companies. My experience is, my career experience, right now our largest client, like I said, is Medtronic. My career experience is with UPS. I worked there for 10 years. I actually helped them launch their rebranding. I was the internal lead for it. And, you know, I've worked at another internal communications company where I helped manage, let's see, I was the president of that company. It was Chick-fil-A, Target, Porsche, Elavon, LexisNexis. So I think that, you know, all of that experience, you know, just gives me an insight. And I've one of the things that I think is really helpful is that I've been on both sides of it. So I've worked inside large organizations. So I understand all of the, you know, the issues and the approvals and the getting buy-in from people and consensus that goes on there. I've also worked, you know, as a consultant outside the company. So that's helpful.
For our listeners that are smaller companies and they maybe aren't a regional or a national or global organization, what advice or would you give them or what direction would you point them in for help if, I'm assuming based on what you said, they're not necessarily in the ideal sense a target for you?
Well, I think that one thing they could do if they're hearing this and they're interested is they could, and if they're suddenly getting a little bit concerned about maybe how their employees are feeling, is to go ahead and start talking to people, to go ahead and survey people, and to get a feeling for where people are, and then try and quantify maybe, you know, they talk about ROI on internal communications and employee engagement. People say, well, I just can't see it. I can't see, you know, it seems like something I don't get money back on. But go ahead and add up the cost of turnover or the cost of losing your big client or winning your next big client, start tallying those things up, and then go and talk to people. And I think most business people will feel that it would make a difference. And so I think they should start there.
Sounds like a great concept that you've landed on and definitely something helpful to business. What challenges do you face in the marketplace in trying to get this message out and get people to engage this type of service to take care of their employee culture?
I think the biggest challenge is that leadership either doesn't know what's going on because they are feeling they're really busy. They just did a study recently, the IBM Global CEO study, actually IBM Global survey with CEOs all over the world, and they said that 8 out of 10 CEOs felt like things were going to get a ton more complicated in the business world, but they didn't feel like they were prepared to manage it. So leadership has been working really hard. They have their head down. They're looking at the numbers, and I think they either don't know or they might feel a little bit defensive because they feel like they're doing the best they can. And there's no, and you know, most leadership, they're doing a great job. They're really committed. They're really dedicated. They're really great people. It might just be that they need to understand how they can connect with their employee base better.
How do you get them to lift their head and pay attention to that? I mean, I get that. The CEO's strapped, head down, all about numbers, pressure of the board, right?
Somebody has to go to them and help them understand that the people are the heart of the brand and the people who, in the end, make your company a success or not a success. And there's different ways. Numbers people will pay attention to numbers, and there are different ways to quantify what the cost of not engaging your people is to your business. And so people need to find a way to do that. And then they'll be surprised how interested CEOs who are only interested in the numbers get.
Makes a lot of sense. So if an organization's out there hearing this and they think, hey, we really need to assess our situation, look at our employees, figure out how to preserve our top talent, how do they go about getting in touch with you and finding out more information?
Well, our website is sparkideasinc.com, and they can email me from the website, but it's jen@sparkideasinc.com. So they could, you know, go to the website, find my phone number, or they could go ahead and send me an email.
I probably have a few more questions I'd like to redirect back at you, but before I do you mind hanging out for a few minutes while we visit with Glenn?
Not at all.
Fantastic. So, Glenn, welcome to the show. I know you've been waiting patiently there, so let's dig in and tap into Bachmann International. You specialize in startups, if I understand correctly, so tell me a little bit about it. And you're a rookie at it. I mean, you got, what, 25 years now? So you're about to get your feet wet. Tell us a little bit about what Bachmann International does.
Okay. Andy, first of all, thanks for having me on your show. And before we get into this, I have a daughter who just got married last week, and she's on her honeymoon right now. Her name's Stuart.
So she's definitely listening in.
Well, yeah, they're down in the Caribbean. I don't know if you know this or not, but next to reggae music, Renegade Radio is huge. So, Stuart,
I've heard this.
Yeah. So, Stuart, if you're listening to this on your honeymoon, it probably means things aren't going great. Give me a call. I love you, baby.
That's awesome. And that will forever be archived. So on her anniversary, you can replay that segment for her.
Absolutely.
All right, great. Thanks, Glenn. Tell us a little bit about Bachmann International, though. Let's get down to the business side of
right.
Glenn Bachmann.
So I've been involved with startup technology companies for 25 years or so, starting off as an entrepreneur and kind of worked into that quite candidly. You know, I went to MBA school a long time ago. I was fortunate to have a really good business mentor, my father, who rose from the ranks, stayed with the same company for a really long time, went to Georgia Tech, and ultimately became CEO of a company. And he always said to me, if you want to make money in life, you really need to get involved with your own business. It's very hard to climb the corporate ranks, that you probably have a better shot. If you want to make money, you have a better shot probably at buying a lottery ticket than climbing the ranks of a large organization.
I don't think a lot of people believed that until about 2008, and then suddenly that reality became all too true for some
Absolutely.
People.
Absolutely. And so, but going to MBA school, you're sort of taught, well, back when I went to MBA school, you couldn't major in entrepreneurship. Marketing was probably the closest thing. So, but you're kind of I don't say brainwashed, but the goal is to go work for a large organization, a Fortune 1000. It's kind of a status thing. It's just kind of what you believe you should be doing. And so I got involved with a couple of large companies. I quickly figured out it really did not play to my skill set. I just didn't really feel like I was making a difference. And it's hard to make a difference when you're working for a global organization. And, you know, to me, the ultimate sort of symptom of that is these large companies run these employee programs, you make a difference, which always tell me, well, I really don't make a difference, otherwise why are they running these programs? They wouldn't need to. So I got involved with my first startup, and I was very young. I was in my mid to late 20s, and it was not a fast journey. It was a 10-year journey. I partnered with a couple of founders. This was pre-internet. It was an online information service for the legal market. And, you know, we almost went out of business several times, but we had a great board. Our initial and angel investors was our board, so they were emotionally invested in what we were doing. And we went on to grow it. We raised venture capital money and eventually had an IPO and sold the company. And so I realized that was really my passion, and I stuck with that.
I see. So let's kind of get into the heart of this angel investment and startup world, because we discussed a little bit before the show, there are a lot of misconceptions out there about what it really is. So maybe take us through some basic steps. What is an angel investor, and how does it really play with a startup?
Right. So in the Atlanta market, which is most angel investors, and an angel investor really is an accredited investor. And what happens is when a company starts up, and we're typically talking technology companies, because in Atlanta, angel investing is primarily a business that has some sort of technology aspect to it. Doesn't have to have intellectual property, but it's typically what we call technology enabled. It's part of their products and services. There's a technology component. And so what happens is when a startup company, to initially capitalize their business, they either are going to use credit cards, their savings, they'll go to friends and family. You know, that's sort of the initial seed capital typically. Then from there, their first outside round of capital would be what's called angel capital, which is professional money. It's before venture capital money, but after friends and family money. And so typically people that do this, and definitely it's a group of renegades, this is not for the lighthearted, it's very high risk. And so it's basically, it's for the most part people who have been entrepreneurs, it's their passion, and they want to stay engaged with startup companies and helping sort of move the needle with a startup that they really feel passionate about.
So what does one need to do to be an angel investor? Are there qualifications, parameters around that?
I mean, from a legal standpoint, there are some net worth and income requirements. But aside from that, anyone can, and actually the laws are starting to change where there's crowdsourcing, for better or for worse, where people can invest in startups. There's pluses and minuses to that. But not really. I mean, you don't have to file for a license with the government. It's really something that you can choose to do as part of your portfolio. Most people, let's say if they're high net worth individuals, they might invest through a private company, through a private equity fund or something like that. And those companies are usually further along. This would typically not be a startup company.
Okay. So I'm kind of leading you into the realm that I wanted to go, and you brought it up. There are some changes that have been proposed and are kind of working their way down the line on this accredited investor side, really making it where people can be involved in the startup investment market without having the high net worth. The old "it takes money to make money" adage is starting to shift. And what do you see as the future of investors that want to play in this startup world?
You know, I really don't know what's going to happen there. I think the pendulum always shifts in one direction dramatically and then the other. You think about the real estate market in Atlanta and financing real estate. You know, we went from the go-go days of interest only to now you got to put down 20%, you know, or a significant down payment. And so I think the pendulum swings. Right now it's swinging toward trying to really spark this economy and create jobs. That's a lot of what's behind that. And it's very difficult for an early stage company to raise capital. They can't go down the traditional path. You know, they're not going to get money from a lender unless they want to personally guarantee the loan. And most people are not going to want to personally guarantee the loan. They're already putting their life out on the line to try to start that company and then to bet the barn on top of that. You know, that's not really advisable. And so, you know, I really don't know how this is going to ultimately play out. In Georgia, there are some tax credits now for angel investing. I would love to see the federal government have a tax credit because that's much more meaningful than a state tax credit. But, you know, so I really don't know. It's just going to have to play out. And, you know, there's going to be, you know, the news is going to magnify the successes and the people that got, you know, that it got burned. And so we'll just have to see.
Well, let's flip over and talk about the other side and talk about the actual startups themselves. What type of businesses, what type of technologies or services do you see emerging in the startup market that really have legs? In other words, which ones are really catching your attention as an investor?
Right. So when you look at startups, if Jennifer and I were going to invest together in a startup, okay, first of all, there are a couple of key things that we would look at. The first thing is we're more likely to stoke a check if we understand the business. The technology can be interesting, but if we don't really understand the market and what it's going to be used to do and what problems it's going to solve in the industry that's going to buy the product, we're less likely to write a check. So the industry or the market is critical, and the people. There's got to be a real confidence. It's really a partnership. And so you have to really have confidence and feel comfortable with the people, the founder or founders that are starting this thing, because that's really who you're banking on. They're the ones that are going to be flying the plane. As far as technologies, there's certain types of businesses in Atlanta that are easier. I'm not going to say easy. They're not easy to get. It's not easy to get funded. But there's some that are easier than others. Mobility is very hot right now. You know, anything with smartphones and cloud computing, software as a service type solutions that are less capital intensive and recurring revenue in nature. Financial transaction related business. IT security, since there's been some successes, you know, big successes in Atlanta. Those would be easier. They're not easy.
Does that differ marketplace to marketplace?
It does. There's certain, like, for example, if you have a consumer, if you're trying to start up and it's a consumer-based product, I would say that Atlanta's really not the best market to go to. I don't look at any consumer-oriented startups because I just don't really, I don't understand that whole aspect of the go-to-market and how do you do that in a cost-effective manner. It's a different animal. It doesn't matter the technology.
So that's kind of a two-parter. One, you're not the guy who's going to understand that business as
right.
an investor, so they're looking at the wrong investor.
That's
and
right.
Two, this market space, in your opinion, is just not as conducive as perhaps another region
right.
of the country.
I think Austin, Texas, as an example, is more consumer B2C-oriented than, say, Atlanta for sure.
Okay, makes a lot of sense.
And Atlanta's probably not the biggest, although there's SEMDA, Southeast Medical Device Association, but, you know, the medical market in Atlanta is not huge. Now, I'm not talking about medical software. I'm talking about medical devices. Mm-hmm. There are other markets that are more active. And a lot of that has to do with where there were successes in a, typically where there are large successes in an area that breeds success. That's why Silicon Valley, where there have been big successes, the people that experience those success stay in, and it sort of feeds on itself.
So when we think about the startup market and, you know, how to get involved and how to get a company off the ground and what types of ideas we should be focused on, I guess we're educated or taught, you know, some things that we see, like Shark Tank, for example.
Right.
You know, are the things we see on there, is that realistic? Is that kind of how a business gets off the ground, or is that just, you know, good TV?
So Shark Tank, of course, is a reality TV show where you have inventors come on to television, and there are five wealthy investors that are sitting there, I've only watched it a few times. I would say Shark Tank is a fun television. It's really it's a cartoon character of angel investing. You know, they're making very quick decisions. They're betting on the product. In some cases, I think they want the founder to step aside, and they want to take their invention and run with it. Angel investing is really very different than that. It's a process. It's a little bit like dating. There's a courtship period. You have to feel a certain chemistry, and then you spend time with that individual trying to get to know them and seeing what makes them tick. The last thing you want is for them to not be involved. They're a big part of the asset, and so it's really it's a process to raise money and to partner with the right people. So I see it as a cartoon show.
Well, let's look at this courtship from two sides, right? And I think it's kind of fitting because it matches up with what we see oftentimes in the real world in the, quote, dating market, right? You've got the really attractive girl, and all the guys want to talk to her. So she's got to figure out, how do I weed out all these yahoos, right? And you got all the yahoos trying to figure out, how do I stand out against the rest of these knuckleheads to actually get a conversation, right? So kind of give us both sides. From an investor, how do you sort through and identify who you're going to give the time to? And as a startup, how do you position yourself to actually get that meeting with an investor?
Right. So I guess we'll start on the entrepreneur side first.
Okay.
So, you know, the first thing that I would say is, on the entrepreneur side, the best way to raise money is to make sales. That's really the best way.
Say that one again, because we need to frame that and have an outtake on it, because I think you really hit the nail on the head there.
Right. The best way to make money is to get customers and get creative about your pricing. You can quote, if you are charging a licensing fee, you can quote monthly, but you can still bill front-end annually or quarterly. You know, you to front-end load that cash coming in to help on cash flow. But that's really, you know, that's the best. The longer, you know, if you can bootstrap your business and self-fund, then you're going to have a better shot at getting funded than, you know, you have no customers, your product may or may not be finished, your product may or may not be started. But if you do need capital, you need to start the process early. And I think mistakes that I see is a lot of people, entrepreneurs, they don't really understand the mentality of an angel investor. They see them as a checkbook. And really, most angel investors, this isn't a surprise to people, it's really not about the money completely. I mean, we want to make money, but we really want to make a difference. And if we only cared about money, we would probably put the capital somewhere else. But, you know, we're trying to make money, give back, make a difference, have a purpose in life. And so if an entrepreneur, they need to understand that to meet somebody and to get them and to ask them to invest, that's really premature. It's like meeting a woman for the first time and, you know, you want to get engaged. It's unnatural. And it's not going to be a healthy relationship if somebody is probably crazy enough to do that. So the best thing to do is to use your trusted network. If you have a law firm, a part-time CFO, people that have access to angel investors to set up introductions. If you can find one that really buys into what you're doing, they get it, and you can get them initially involved in an advisory capacity, and then maybe that evolves into an investor capacity. And then from that person can help you open up doors and raise capital for you because they're really bought in. And then on the flip side, on the angel investing side, the best meetings to take are from trusted sources. If somebody calls you and they're personally putting their money in, you're going to take a meeting. You're going to take a meeting. Even if you're not highly interested, you're probably going to take that meeting because you might need that angel. You look at an executive summary and you form a quick opinion, but sometimes you'll then get in and hear a more involved presentation. You're like, wow, I didn't really get that when I read this. So who the deal comes in from is very critical. I'm personally a member of a couple of different angel organizations. The largest one is Atlanta Technology Angels that Mike Eckert is chairman of. There are about 80 angels in that group. From the name, you can tell you need to have some sort of technology aspect to your product. Another one is called Angel Lounge that Charlie Paparelli runs. He's a well-known angel investor here in town. And that one is affiliated with an organization called Startup Lounge, which helps the ecosystem for startup companies. So there's no shortage of deal flow. And I know that there's frustration on both sides. It's not really a super efficient process. You can go to ATA, Atlanta Technology Angels, website and fill out an application and to try to get an initial meeting. But really the best way to do it is if you can find a relationship, nurture that relationship with an angel, and then sort of have them pull you.
So who would people get in touch with if they've got a startup, they're trying to get that momentum, trying to build it? Would you recommend they reach out to Bachman International directly, go to your website, or visit one of these groups? What type of direction would you send people in?
You know, I would say that the first thing that you should do is to explore an incubator or an accelerator that has an environment to help the startup ecosystem. And there are many good ones in Atlanta. One of the best is down at Georgia Tech. You don't need to be an alum of Georgia Tech or go to Georgia Tech. It's called ATDC. I think the website's atdc.org, but I won't promise that. It's very inexpensive to join, but you get mentoring. They will help you get ready to sort of get your business in shape to help you take capital in if it's appropriate for you to take capital in. MLA Investments is funding an accelerator called Flashpoint, where you apply to get in. There's an incubator in Gwinnett Innovation Park in Gwinnett County. There's one in Decatur, 151 Locust, that Ed Reichert, the mayor of Avondale Estates, runs that. So I would start there, and because you need mentoring, whether you've done this before or not, you need help. There's a lot of moving parts. That's really where I would say is the best place to start.
Okay, well, I want to bring Jennifer back in at this point, and the first place I want to start off addressing, I thought it was really interesting, as Glenn got started, Jennifer, he talked about being in the corporate world and not feeling like he was making a difference, which was exactly what we were talking about, and then the program that was designed to make him feel like he was making a difference, he said, made him realize he didn't make a difference. How do you address that in the corporate world so that employees feel like they're making a difference without feeling patronized for feeling like they make a difference?
Right. Well, I think that is something that is a challenge when you are trying to help employees understand that they do make a difference. And there's not a one solution that works for every company. And obviously what Glenn experienced, it didn't work for him. And
you can call Glenn a problem child if you want to. We're okay with that, too. Sometimes it's just a bad seed.
And sometimes people are really great people, and they just don't, just because the company wasn't right for them, or, it just wasn't a good fit, just like, a marriage or even dating for a long time doesn't work. But you have to, management needs to get at the heart of it and figure out how to do it in a way that's not patronizing. And a lot of times if management really isn't committed to it and they really just, when it comes down to it, they don't care how you're feeling, then, people see through that. You can't lie to employees, and employees can't lie to leadership. Ultimately, people figure it out. Nobody, everybody's smarter than you give them credit for. And hopefully you give them a lot of credit already.
How do companies manage culture evolution? I mean, as a startup, you're going to have a culture. But as that company grows and expands, having talked to a lot of startups myself, we know what worked culture-wise early doesn't work later on. How do you migrate through that? I'll let you both take a crack at that one.
That's a great question. And it's very hard to maintain your culture if you are fortunate enough to get some traction, and then you're able to start hiring employees. And it gets compounded when there are remote employees involved.
Which that's a lot more norm these days.
It is a lot more norm. I don't know that I have the magic answer for that. I mean, I've certainly made hiring mistakes in startups. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges is, I would say, for me, and again, I don't know that this is right or not, we all have our personal, we're all biased by our personal experiences in life. What I always try to look for is someone who is fit the culture as far as the work environment. If you're going to put them in a remote setting, does that work for them? Can they work by themselves? Are they used to that? In a startup environment, there's typically not a lot of structure. Some people thrive in that, and some people need to know sort of a structured game plan of what's going to be going on. So, I try to look at the background of what they're used to and where they were successful and see how does that fit with the environment. And then I think the other things are, the culture, there's some basic cultures which are, when you're in a startup, typically you've got to be very results focused. You have to be very customer oriented. There has to be a culture of openness, because you're not going to have all the answers, and people need to feel like that they have a voice. That one of the things that drives people to early stage companies is they do want to make a difference and they do want to be heard. And so you need to create that culture. Also, as an investor, you want founders that are coachable and open. Otherwise, you're going to have some really ugly board meetings, and you're burning cash, and you're arguing, and the clock is ticking. So that
applies even as they get larger. Jennifer, you pointed that out, is sometimes leadership is the greatest challenge, because they want you to come in and fix their employees, and that's not really where the problem is.
Right. Well, it's people want to often say it's just, what makes a good culture, and people are hoping it's only good managers, or it's only good employees, or it's paying people a lot of money, or it's making it's a just everything. It's a combination of all things. And I think when you're looking at a business, you have to at least put equal emphasis on people as money.
So if I'm trying to define a new culture, I'm trying to get traction in my organization, I'm trying to retain good employees and good talents, our show really is we talk about breaking the rules of conventional thinking. What are some of the conventional thought processes or mindsets regarding culture inside of an organization that makes them stagnant, and leadership really needs to think outside of the box and shift directions in order to go forward in the future and be a leading company?
I think one thing that people still think is that leadership says it's top down. Leadership says something and everybody's supposed to do it without questioning it. And yet the way the business world works these days, we need for employees and people to be as innovative and thinking up new things. And, you know, our economy needs it. We all need for workers to feel inspired and be at their very best every day.
That's so true. I just saw a survey on innovation for companies recently, and that was a huge theme of it, looking both at, from a manager standpoint, do you allow your employees to lead, to think, to expand, and do you reward them for that? And then, of course, it also asked the flip side from the employee's perspective. Did they feel they were listened to? Did they feel they were recognized and rewarded for these ideas?
Right. So leadership really needs to listen to the ideas. And a lot of times, you know, you can't act on every idea from every employee, but there needs to be some sort of system in place where people know they're at least being heard and that people are taking the time to listen to them. And so I think the top-down structure is and should be gone. And it's just a matter now of people adjusting to that.
Glenn, in the startup market, what do people think conventionally that may limit them, hold them back because of changes that are either occurring or on the horizon for the, you know, the startup market? They need to think outside the box and do differently to really be successful.
You know, the biggest issue that I see, and because again, this is more technology-centric deals, and is that there needs to be earlier in the process customer engagement. And too many times you'll see entrepreneurs that have a tech background and they sort of have their heads down, they're building their product, but they don't really have a feel for the market and how important is this problem being solved. They're working on features that the market may or may not care about. And so I think that it's almost like holding yourself back because you feel like I'm not ready yet to go see customers. Well, you could take a good PowerPoint presentation to a customer. There's an old saying, people support what they help create. And if you get customers involved early in the process and they feel like they're helping to shape your solution, you end up with a better solution and you end up with some natural pilot customers. So that customer involvement, because really that's really what gets most startups is their inability to get traction in the market.
Well, and it gets us back to that point of go sell something. Even if the product's not finished, even if it's not perfect,
right.
Go sell something.
That's right.
Versus the old adage of build a better mousetrap and the world will be the path to your door, which
right.
just doesn't seem to hold true
That's
anymore.
That's right.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much. Before we wrap up today, let's give your contact information one more time. So if people are either looking for your services or have some questions or maybe just want to connect with you, I don't know, via LinkedIn or I don't know how I plugged you into social media you guys are. But any way you'd like to be reached by our listener audience, let's give that information now. Jennifer, let me start with you.
Well, again, my website's sparkideasinc.com. And also, I am on LinkedIn and you can just link in with me. It's Jennifer Bull at Spark Ideas. Just search me and I'm there.
Great.
Thank
Glenn,
you.
How about getting in touch with you?
Yes. I'm also on LinkedIn, Bachman International, Glenn Bachman. You can Google that. My email address is Glenn with two N's, Bachman at att.net, or you can also apply into Atlanta Technology Angels if you have a technology venture and you want to have it taken a look at. You can mention my name and maybe it'll find its way to me.
Awesome information. Guys, thank you again so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate you being here and sharing with our listeners. if you're out there in the audience, hopefully you got something today that's going to help you move forward, excel, make a difference, and really be part of the turnaround in this economy. We all have the talent to make it happen. We just got to get out there and do the legwork. As always, I'm your host, Andy Lowe. This has been Renegade Radio. We're brought to you by Renegade Concepts and the good folks here at Business Radio X. And as always, remember, opportunity lies in the impossible, but you have to be willing to break the rules of conventional thinking. Until next time.